I started working with ICPJ a long time ago. In fact, I'll tell you what I did first for ICPJ, and that'll tell you something about how long ago it was. I started out by filing index cards for each member in alphabetical order, so and putting little information on them. And as you can imagine, we have not used index cards for a very long time. So I did that as a volunteer for a couple of years while I was in graduate school. And then I was invited to be on the steering committee, which is also called the board. I was on the steering committee for a number of years, working with mostly more administrative aspects and policy aspects of ICPJ. And I really found that interesting. I'm very interested in how organizations work and wanting them to work well, et cetera, et cetera. But along about 2008, we had a congregational outreach meeting where we broke up into different, two or three or four different sections, content sections, and one of them was on the environment. I had had a concern for environmental issues for a long time. I went to Earth Day many, many years ago. I had been, you know, interested and concerned and done a little reading, but had not really ever done much actively. But that meeting gave us the opportunity to actually start a group, which eventually became a task force. It's now called the Climate Change and Earth Care Task Force. And a couple of the people who were there at that meeting that night are still on the task force, Dick Brown and Edie Hurst, as well as myself, of course. Gertrude Workington was on the task force for quite a while, Lisa Dugdale, Lynn Meadows. Lynn unfortunately died a couple of years ago, and we really miss her positive energy and her personal walking the walk. Dick and Edie are, as I said, are still on the task force, along with a number of other regulars. Bob Milstein is an active person at this point, Al Connor, Max Pettibone, and I'd like to also mention Anya and Rob Kiefer, who were very active for a period of time and did some very good and useful work and were part of a couple of press conferences and so forth. So the mission, we of course had to stop and figure out what our mission was and write it down, is to involve the faith community in addressing the climate crisis and caring for creation. And we promote environmental stewardship at the personal, congregational, and policy levels. Now, we don't, of course, stop with the faith community. We, like all of ICPJ's work, we work with people of faith and people of conscience. But we do have done work with congregations, a fair amount of work with congregations. Also, we've done work with the personal level of change and also with policy. I guess some people might ask why I'm doing this work with ICPJ, because there certainly are a variety of places in town where I could do it. Perhaps it's obvious enough to just say that I've had a long-time connection with ICPJ, but there's more than that. I find it a very comfortable place to work. The people I'm working with have very similar, they're very different in each from the other, but they also have some very similar values. And I think also it's important to me that we come from a perspective of understanding, whatever our religious beliefs, understanding that all life is sacred and that the earth that sustains us is sacred. The Climate Change and Earth Care Task Force has done a lot of work on energy and fossil fuel issues over the years. The first thing we worked on actually turned out to be kind of a test of my faith in a funny way. Quakers, I'm a Quaker, and Quakers have a concept that's called way will open. It means if you feel that things should be happening, that you're led to move in a certain direction and it seems like there are obstacles, the way will open. Frankly, I have not had a lot of, I have had mixed feelings about that testimony, but in fact, I had an experience where that really did happen. President Obama had just been elected, and it seemed to me really important, since he was committed to work on the environment, that we give him support and nudges, in fact, to, you know, the kind of thing that he said he would do, that we would make it very clear that the public wanted him to do. And the first 100 days has a kind of ethos about it that we thought, okay, we would like to do something for the first 100 days. However, I was working full time. The task force I was working with didn't have a huge amount of energy. I knew I couldn't do what I really wanted us to do and that we couldn't do it with the personnel we had, but I figured, well, we just need to do what we can do. If it's not as much as I want, all right. And, in fact, way did open. A great intern showed up just in the nick of time, and she was wonderful to work with, and she knew how to deal with electronic and email and action alerts that I hadn't at that point really familiarized myself with, and she had the kind of connections to know what organizations might be sending out things that we could participate in. And that intern who was so useful and who appeared at such a wonderful moment, her name was Melanie McDowell, and if she's out there somewhere, I thank her very much for being part of our work. Between her and myself and several other people, we were able to organize over 50 people to commit to responding to action alerts for the first 100 days. And I was very, very pleased with the, it was our little bit of effort into a big pool of other people's efforts, but it felt really good that we were able to do as much as that, especially at such an early stage of our task force. The other major thing that we worked on a few years later, this was still in the days when we thought that Congress might pass some climate legislation, and we were trying to work hard that it be strong climate legislation and really productive. And we worked to organize faith leaders. We got over 140, mostly clergy, faith leaders from various traditions, and to sign a letter to our senators. We had a couple of press conferences with clergy. One was in Ann Arbor, one was in Detroit. We had a couple of meetings with senators' aides, and clergy from Christian, Jewish, and earth-based faiths. And not least, we did some whimsical but serious photo messages to our senators. We had a sort of cartoon bubble on whiteboard that was cut out, and we wrote on it, "Stop climate change because ... And then we sat at the Ypsilanti Downtown Farmers Market and the Ann Arbor Green Fair and asked passersby if they'd like to fill in their answer to that and if we could take a photo of them and use it in whatever way we wanted to. We got a lot of takers. People wrote serious things. People wrote funny things. Even the mayor wrote something at the Green Fair because he was wandering through. And we compiled them into a collage and sent them off to our senators as I said, a kind of whimsical but serious message about why we care and how many different kinds of people care about climate change. We also worked on the Michigan ballot initiative a few years ago called 25 by 25, which stood for 25, getting all of our electricity by renewable energy, 25% of it by 2025. It was a handy slogan. Unfortunately, it did not pass, but we spent some time organizing clergy support, letter writing, et cetera, educating people, and followed up by going to the governor's energy hearings in the next few months and doing a letter writing campaign about that as well. So the last couple of years, unfortunately, neither Congress nor the state legislature has been likely to do anything very creative or useful on energy issues or climate change issues. So we've turned to both other issues, but also some other ways of working on energy issues, primarily through public rallies, vigils, and hearings. It's interesting, a lot of those produce for me memories and images and that some of the other work doesn't as much. A couple of us joined a march and rally at the Marathon Refinery in Detroit on tar sands oil, and it was a beautiful sunny day, but the smell of the refinery was right there in our noses all the time. A number of us from the task force were part of a Keystone XL pipeline vigil, and it was very cold. We were so bundled up we couldn't recognize each other. And then several of us also traveled to New York City for the People's Climate March in September of 2014. It was really an amazing and inspiring process, and we were all glad that we went and hope that people who are in power to do something about it were listening to the 400,000 people of us who were there. So we educate, we do efforts, we join large efforts at change. But so much of our work feels like throwing sandbags on the dike, or maybe putting grains of sand in the sandbags for somebody to throw on the dike. So I want to mention one other thing that we were a small part of, but which had a much more concrete impact. ICPJ, a couple of different task forces, have had a long, slow focus on local transit issues. We did some breakfast, clergy breakfasts and other kinds of events several years ago. And then when the actual campaign for the vote happened, we were a small part of ICPJ's effort, which was a part of a larger effort, of course. But the exciting thing is that we really had a genuine victory, that we did get better transit for the Ann Arbor-Ypsilanti area. And public transit, in addition to being really important for the people who need to use it, has a big impact on the carbon footprint. So I am happy that I can at least be a part of a concrete accomplishment, as well as a lot of efforts to educate and to put our effort into larger issues where we never know how much effect we have. Climate Change and Earth Care Task Force has done a lot of work on food and climate change, and I can trace that work back to a specific experience that I had. The task force put on what's called a Cool Congregations workshop with Michigan Interfaith Power and Light in the fall of 2009, and with some help from Voices for Earth Justice. We had over 30 people from 15 congregations at that workshop, and it was a great workshop. But the thing that really hit me was, when we measured our own personal carbon footprint, they had a place for food, and they talked a little bit about how much food can affect our personal carbon footprint. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm very well aware of transportation and heating and cooling and how much difference that makes, but I hadn't thought about how much different food can make. I made a personal resolve at that point. I'm not a vegetarian, let alone a vegan, but I made a personal resolve at that point to try to eat one meal a day vegan. And I have mostly kept to that. I'm not rigid about it, but I have, and some days I eat more than one. So I also got to thinking that for me personally, it's a lot more interesting and fun to think about food and to think about how I can change my carbon footprint through food than about, I mean, I turn my thermostat down and I drive a car that doesn't get, you know, that gets good gas mileage, but it's just more fun to think about food. And I thought, well, that might be true for other people as well. And I was pretty sure, especially at that point, that not many people realized how much food had an effect on their carbon footprint. I think now it's becoming much more visible, and there have been articles about it, and I think more people are aware of it. So the following summer after that workshop, we piloted a challenge project to try to get people to eat lower carbon, less meat, more organic, less waste, try being vegan one day a week for a certain period, et cetera. And we, again, sat at the farmers markets and at the green fair and signed people up to try this challenge. And a number of people signed up. Not all of them did it, but we offered a prize to the lucky winner of people who let us know that they actually had done it. So a fair number of people actually did do the challenge. In the fall, we continued with a food theme, and we designed the educational materials for ICPJ's Crop Hunger Walk. We had handouts, of course, and written materials, but we also did educational posters at the rest stops with Burmeshave-type signs leading up to them. And if you're old enough, you know what a Burmeshave sign is, but if you're not, let me describe it. As people were driving along the highways in a number of years ago, you would see a four-line verse, one line at a time. You'd see the first line, you'd drive just a little farther, you know, not far enough to forget the first line. There'd be the second line, there'd be the third line, there'd be the fourth line, and then the fifth little plaque would say, Burmeshave. So we took that idea, and I'll read you one example of what we did. The weather's changed, the harvest's poor. The people's food supply's unsure. In some small way we'd give relief if only we would eat less beef. Planet save. So we just thought that was kind of a fun way to make our points. We moved on from that to create materials called Eating for a Healthy World. Did a lot of research, which was kind of fun and interesting, and put together materials so that people could we culled them down into a fairly short set of documents so that people could read it without falling asleep. And then we created a 5-week challenge. The five things, each week had a number of actions you could choose to do. You certainly didn't need to do all of them. The first week was to reduce meat and dairy, which is a huge contributor to climate change. Second one was to eat locally and eat seasonally. The third was to choose whole and organic food. The fourth was to decrease packaging and food waste, and food waste is also a huge contributor to climate change. And then last but certainly not least, we said celebrate farmers, farm workers, and fair food, because we need to recognize all the people who are part of that web of food that we participate in every day. We worked with five different congregations. In some cases, we just did a presentation, an informational session about this, but three of them did the challenge, and to varying degrees and with varying numbers of people, but it was interesting to get people to actually try changing their eating and see what that was like and see what came out of it. We actually used the materials and the concept again a couple of times this fall and winter as we've been undertaking an organization-wide food and justice program. And we've done a number of other environmental things and are just in the process now of getting people to do challenges. For example, eating meatless one day a week for 6 weeks, or not using bottled beverages or canned beverages one day a week for 6 weeks. We also encourage people to do group things like potlucks that are designed to be more carbon friendly, or book studies to learn about all of this stuff. We will be doing a science cafe, which will be informing people about how the way we eat affects the climate in various ways. And last but not least, we have a policy challenge, getting people to sign up to participate in relatively small ways on policy issues that will affect food. We're just in the middle of one that has a particular meaning to me, because it's a place where we don't just click on somebody's campaign about food policy, but we do something that has a more personal human connection. One of our ICPJ chairpeople of the Latin America Task Force, Marianne Perón, is actually in El Salvador right now and has longstanding connections with El Salvador. She's there for reasons that don't have to do with this action alert, but she is meeting, among other things, with a group of folks who are working on an issue that relates to some other of the issues that we're working on. There's a international mining company called Pacific Rim, recently bought by Oceana Gold, that wants to have a mine on the one large river in El Salvador. And the government has said, no, we do not want you to mine on this river. There's too much danger from the toxins, both to the water and the land around it. You would think that would be where things would stop. The government says no, but that's not true. There are intricate trade agreements that unfortunately allow this company to sue the government of El Salvador for $300 million. And because El Salvador is a very poor country, that's a serious problem. This suit has been going on for several years already, and other organizations, certainly local organizations and also international organizations such as Oxfam, have weighed in, but it still goes on. One little side story that I found, it's one of those tiny victories that doesn't lead to necessarily a lasting victory, but at one point during this process, the company came to the man who was then the Archbishop of El Salvador, who was a relatively conservative archbishop, and they told him their story and they wanted to get him on their side to support this mine. And he listened very politely, and when they finished, he said, you know, before I became a priest, I was a mining engineer, and a lot of what you're telling me is simply not true about the effect that this mine will or will not have, and so I will not support it. So it's one of those small, small victories where you are just happy that the right person is there at the right time. So what we're doing is we have a statement of support for the people of El Salvador that they should have the right to make their own decision about how their resources are used and that they should not be subject to a multinational corporation deciding how their resources should be used and how their river and how their land should be polluted. And we have collected signatures, and I will be sending those to Marianne, and she will present them to the folks that she's meeting with who are working on it in the country, just as a show of our support. And whether it will make a difference, who knows? One little drop of water, one little grain of sand, hopefully it will be meaningful to them to know that there are people that they never met, who they wouldn't expect to know about them, who do know about them, who do care. And we will see where this all comes out. One of the other issues we've been working on, which feels like throwing little grains of sand, but hopefully important grains of sand, is on something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, TPP. Now, if you're anything like me, your eyes glaze over when you hear anything about trade agreements, which I, up until the point I started looking at this, knew virtually nothing about and cared virtually nothing about. But it turns out that the Trans-Pacific, the TPP, if it is passed, could have lots and lots of very negative consequences for all kinds of groups and all kinds of people. The reason it isn't necessarily, it's not been in the news, it's being kept rather secret because, or at least this is the theory that some people have, if it was highly visible and if the public knew about it, they would not like it and they would get their congresspeople, both on the right and on the left, to vote against it. And in fact, there are a lot of congresspeople on the right and on the left who do have concerns about it and are likely to vote against it, but we don't know yet if there are enough. One of the many issues that this trade agreement has is something called investor-state tribunals, which allow corporations, multinational corporations, to sue governments if they feel like the government is interfering with profits that they expected to make. Well, that could be, of course, a great deal of, I mean, maybe there are probably some cases where maybe there's some justice in that. It also, unfortunately, turns out that most of the time when it has been used in the past under NAFTA or CAFTA, it is not a just thing for the people of the country. However, these tribunals are not government tribunals. They are made up of people who are often working for the companies when they are not being judges in the tribunals. And in fact, 70% of the ones that have happened thus far have come out in favor of the companies. So this whole set of issues is very troubling to us. It also has a lot of implications for food and for how food is raised, because corporations have a lot to do with how this treaty is, or how this trade agreement is being organized, and they are the ones who will benefit the most from it. And of course, large corporate agriculture is what they would be in favor of. However, the United Nations has a recent report that says if we're going to feed the world, what we really need to do is focus on small, environmentally sound agriculture for local people, not massive global factory farms or corporate agriculture. We had an opportunity recently to go to the congressperson from this district's office and meet with somebody to talk about our concern about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Two of us went, one from myself from a more environmental point of view and the other one from a Latin America point of view, and had a very good meeting. Very fortunately, our representative has an understanding of the TPP and of the issues of what's called fast track, which is an effort to get it passed without much debate, and she has already stood up against it. But it was useful for us to go and present our own point of view and give her some documents and let her know how much we care about this issue. And in fact, this issue ties into another very human kind of connection that we're making with an issue that is part of what's called CAFTA, a similar kind of trade agreement in El Salvador, and how they're being affected by a multinational corporation that is wanting to do a gold mine.